post that. "But he'll not marry anyone else," she said, "not as long as I live. And we are surrogates, as I've said. To break up this natural order in our affairs, to disturb, disrupt, and confuse us, which target offers itself most enticingly to the Harkonnens?" He sensed the direction she was taking, and his brows drew down in a lowering scowl. "The Duke?" she asked. "Attractive target, yes, but no one with the possible exception of Paul is better guarded. Me? I tempt them, surely, but they must know the Bene Gesserit make difficult targets. And there's a better target, one whose duties create, necessarily, a monstrous blind spot. One to whom suspicion is as natural as breathing, one who builds his entire life on innuendo and mystery." She darted her right hand toward him. "You!" Howard started to leap from his chair. "I have not dismissed you, Thufir," she flared. The old Mentat almost fell back into the chair, so quickly did his muscles betray him. She smiled without mirth. "Now you know something of the real training they give us," she said. Howard tried to swallow in a dry throat. Her command had been regal, peremptory, uttered in a tone and manner he had found completely irresistible. His body had obeyed her before he could think about it. Nothing could have prevented his response, not logic, not passionate anger, nothing. To do what she had done spoke of a sensitive, intimate knowledge of the person thus commanded, a depth of control he had not dreamed possible. "I have said to you before that we should understand each other," she said. "I meant you should understand me. I already understand you. And I tell you now that your loyalty to the Duke is all that guarantees your safety with me." He stared at her, wet his lips with his tongue. "If I desired a puppet, the Duke would marry me," she said. "He might even think he did it of his own free will." Howard lowered his head, looked upward through his sparse lashes. Only the most rigid control kept him from calling the guard. Control, and the suspicion now that woman might not permit it. His skin crawled with the memory of how she had controlled him. In the moment of hesitation, she could have drawn a weapon and killed him. "Does every human have this blind spot?" he wondered. "Can any of us be ordered into action before he can resist?" The idea staggered him. Who could stop a person with such power? "You've glimpsed the fist within the Bene Gesserit glove," she said. "Few glimpse it and live. And what I did was a relatively simple thing for us. You've not seen my entire arsenal. Think on that." "Why aren't you out destroying the Duke's enemies?" he asked. "What would you have me destroy?" she asked. "Would you have me make a weakling of our Duke, have him forever leaning on me?" "But with such power—" "Power's a two-edged sword, Thufir," she said. "You think how easy for her to shape a human tool to thrust into an enemy's vitals." "True, Thufir, even into your vitals. Yet what would I accomplish? If enough of us Bene Gesserit did this, wouldn't it make all Bene Gesserit suspect? We don't want that, Thufir. We do not wish to destroy ourselves," she nodded. "We truly exist only to serve." "I cannot answer you," he said. "You know I cannot answer." "You'll say nothing about what has happened here to anyone," she said. "I know you, Thufir." "My lady." Again the old man tried to swallow in a dry throat, and he thought, "She has great powers, yes. But would these not make her an even more formidable tool for the Harkonnens?" "The Duke could be destroyed as quickly by his friends as by his enemies," she said. "I trust now you'll get to the bottom of this suspicion and remove it." "If it proves baseless," he said. "If," she sneered. "If," he said. "You are tenacious," she said. "Cautious," he said, "and aware of the error factor." "Then I'll pose another question for you. What does it mean to you that you stand before another human, that you are bound and helpless, and the other human holds a knife at your throat, yet this other human refrains from killing you, frees you from your bonds, and gives you the knife to use as you will?" She lifted herself out of the chair, turned her back on him. "You may go now, Thufir," The old Mentat arose, hesitated, hand creeping toward the deadly weapon beneath his tunic. He was reminded of the bull ring, and of the Duke's father, who'd been brave, no matter what his other failings, and one day of the corrida long ago. The fierce black beast had stood there, head bowed, immobilized and confused. The old Duke had turned his back on the horns, cape thrown flamboyantly over one arm, while cheers rained down from the stands. "I am the bull and she the matador," Howard thought. He withdrew his hand from the weapon, glanced at the sweat glistening in his empty palm. And he knew that whatever the facts proved to be in the end, he would never forget this moment, nor lose this sense of supreme admiration for the Lady Jessica. Quietly, he turned and left the room. Jessica lowered her gaze from the reflection in the windows, turned and stared at the closed door. "Now we'll see some proper action," she whispered.
Do you wrestle with dreams? Do you contend with shadows? Do you move in a kind of sleep? Time has slipped away. Your life is stolen. You tarried with trifles, victim of your folly. Dirge for Jamis on the funeral plain from Songs of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
Leto stood in the foyer of his house, studying a note by the light of a single suspensor lamp. Dawn was yet a few hours away, and he felt his tiredness. A Fremen messenger had brought the note to the outer guard just now as the Duke arrived from his command post. The note read, "A column of smoke by day, a pillar of fire by night." There was no signature. What does it mean? He wondered. The messenger had gone without waiting for an answer, and before he could be questioned, he had slipped into the night like some smoky shadow. Leto pushed the paper into a tunic pocket, thinking to show it to Hawat later. He brushed a lock of hair from his forehead, took a sighing breath. The anti-fatigue pills were beginning to wear thin. It had been a long 2 days since the dinner party, and longer than that since he had slept. On top of all the military problems, there had been the disquieting session with Hawat, the report on his meeting with Jessica. Should I waken Jessica? He wondered. There's no reason to play the secrecy game with her any longer, or is there? Blast and damn that Duncan, Idaho. He shook his head. No, not Duncan. I was wrong not to take Jessica into my confidence from the first. I must do it now, before more damage is done. The decision made him feel better, and he hurried from the foyer through the great hall and down the passages toward the family wing. At the turn where the passages split to the service area, he paused. A strange mewling came from somewhere down the service passage. Leto put his left hand to the switch on his shield belt, slipped his kinjal into his right hand. The knife conveyed a sense of reassurance. That strange sound had sent a chill through him. Softly, the Duke moved down the service passage, cursing the inadequate illumination. The smallest of suspensors had been spaced about 8 meters apart along here and tuned to their dimmest level. The dark stone walls swallowed the light. A dull blob stretching across the floor appeared out of the gloom ahead. Leto hesitated, almost activated his shield, but refrained because that would limit his movements, his hearing, and because the captured shipment of laserguns had left him filled with doubts. Silently he moved toward the gray blob, saw that it was a human figure, a man face down on the stone. Leto turned him over with a foot, knife poised, bent close in the dim light to see the face. It was the smuggler, Tuek, a wet stain down his chest. The dead eyes stared with empty darkness. Leto touched the stain, warm. How could this man be dead here? Leto asked himself. Who killed him? The mewling sound was louder here. It came from ahead and down the side passage to the central room where they had installed the main shield generator for the house. Hand on belt switch, kinjal poised, the Duke skirted the body, slipped down the passage, and peered around the corner toward the shield generator room. Another gray blob lay stretched on the floor a few paces away. and he saw at once this was the source of the noise. The shape crawled toward him with painful slowness, gasping, mumbling. Leto stilled his sudden constriction of fear, darted down the passage, crouched beside the crawling figure. It was Mapes, the Fremen housekeeper. Her hair tumbled around her face, clothing disarrayed. A dull shininess of dark stains spread from her back along her side. He touched her shoulder, and she lifted herself on her elbows, head tipped up to peer at him, the eyes black-shadowed emptiness.
"Sew," she gasped. "Killed guard sent get tuek escape, m'lady. You hear no."
She flopped forward, her head thumping against the stone. Leto felt for pulse at the temples. There was none. He looked at the stain. She'd been stabbed in the back. Who? His mind raced. Did she mean someone had killed a guard? And Tuek, had Jessica sent for him? Why? He started to stand up. A sixth sense warned him. He flashed a hand toward the shield switch. Too late. A numbing shock slammed his arm aside. He felt pain there, saw a dart protruding from the sleeve, sensed paralysis spreading from it up his arm. It took an agonizing effort to lift his head and look down the passage. Yui stood in the open door of the generator room. His face reflected yellow from the light of a single brighter suspensor above the door. There was stillness from the room behind him. No sound of generators. Yui, Leto thought. He sabotaged the house generators. We're wide open. Yui began walking toward him, pocketing a dart gun. Leto found he could still speak, gasped.
Yui, how?
Then the paralysis reached his legs, and he slid to the floor with his back propped against the stone wall. Yui's face carried a look of sadness as he bent over, touched Leto's forehead. The Duke found he could feel the touch, but it was remote, dull.
"The drug on the dart is selective," Yui said. "You can speak, but I'd advise against it."
He glanced down the hall, and again bent over Leto, pulled out the dart, tossed it aside. The sound of the dart clattering on the stones was faint and distant to the Duke's ears.
"It can't be Yui," Leto thought. "He's conditioned." "How?" Leto whispered.
"I'm sorry, my dear Duke, but there are things which will make greater demands than this."
He touched the diamond tattoo on his forehead.
"I find it very strange myself, an override on my pyretic conscience, but I wish to kill a man. Yes, I actually wish it. I will stop at nothing to do it."
He looked down at the Duke.
"Oh, not you, my dear Duke. The Baron Harkonnen. I wish to kill the Baron."
Baron,
"Be quiet, please, my poor Duke. You haven't much time. That peg tooth I put in your mouth after the tumble at Narkal, that tooth must be replaced. In a moment I'll render you unconscious and replace that tooth."
He opened his hand, stared at something in it.
"An exact duplicate, its core shaped most exquisitely like a nerve. It'll escape the usual detectors, even a fast scanning, but if you bite down hard on it, the cover crushes. Then, when you expel your breath sharply, you fill the air around you with a poison gas. Most deadly."
Leto stared up at Yui, seeing madness in the man's eyes, the perspiration along brow and chin.
"You were dead anyway, my poor Duke," Yui said. "But you will get close to the Baron before you die. He'll believe you're stupefied by drugs beyond any dying effort to attack him. And you will be drugged and tied. But attack can take strange forms, and you will remember the tooth. The tooth, Duke Leto Atreides. You will remember the tooth."
The old doctor leaned closer and closer until his face and drooping mustache dominated Leto's narrowing vision.
"The tooth," Yui muttered.
"Why?"
Leto whispered. Yui lowered himself to one knee beside the Duke.
I made a shaitan's bargain with the Baron, and I must be certain he has fulfilled his half of it. When I see him, I'll know. When I look at the Baron, then I will know. But I'll never enter his presence without the price. You're the price, my poor Duke. And I'll know when I see him. My poor Juana taught me many things, and one is to see certainty of truth when the stress is great. I cannot do it always, but when I see the Baron, then I will know.
Leto tried to look down at the tooth in Yui's hand. He felt this was happening in a nightmare. It couldn't be. Yui's purple lips turned up in a grimace.
I'll not get close enough to the Baron, or I'd do this myself. No, I'll be detained at a safe distance. But you, now, you, my lovely weapon, he'll want you close to him, to gloat over you, to boast a little.
Leto found himself almost hypnotized by a muscle on the left side of Yui's jaw. The muscle twisted when the man spoke. Yui leaned closer.
And you, my good Duke, my precious Duke, you must remember this tooth.
He held it up between thumb and forefinger.
It will be all that remains to you.
Leto's mouth moved without sound, then,
refuse.
Ah, no, you mustn't refuse, because in return for this small service, I'm doing a thing for you. I will save your son and your woman. No other can do it. They can be removed to a place where no Harkonnen can reach them.
How save them?
Leto whispered.
By making it appear they are dead, by secreting them among people who draw knife at hearing the Harkonnen name, who hate the Harkonnens so much they'll burn a chair in which a Harkonnen has sat, salt the ground over which a Harkonnen has walked.
He touched Leto's jaw.
Can you feel anything in your jaw?
The Duke found that he couldn't answer. He sensed distant tugging, saw Yui's hand come up with the ducal signet ring.
"For Paul," Yui said. "You'll be unconscious presently. Goodbye, my poor Duke. When next we meet, we'll have no time for conversation."
Cool remoteness spread upward from Leto's jaw across his cheeks. The shadowy hall narrowed to a pinpoint with Yui's purple lips centered in it.
"Remember the tooth,"
Yui hissed.
"The tooth."
There should be a science of discontent. People need hard times and oppression to develop psychic muscles. From Collected Sayings of Muad'Dib. By the Princess Irulan.
Jessica awoke in the dark, feeling premonition in the stillness around her. She couldn't understand why her mind and body felt so sluggish. Skin raspings of fear ran along her nerves. She thought of sitting up and turning on a light, but something stayed the decision. Her mouth felt strange. Lump, 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 lump. It was a dull sound, directionless in the dark. Somewhere. The waiting moment was packed with time, with rustling needlestick movements. She began to feel her body, grew aware of bindings on wrists and ankles, a gag in her mouth. She was on her side, hands tied behind her. She tested the bindings, realized they were crimskull fiber, would only claw tighter as she pulled. And now she remembered. There had been movement in the darkness of her bedroom, something wet and pungent slapped against her face, filling her mouth, hands grasping for her. She had gasped one indrawn breath, sensing the narcotic in the wetness. Consciousness had receded, sinking her into a black bin of terror. "It has come," she thought. How simple it was to subdue the Bene Gesserit. All it took was treachery. How it was right. She forced herself not to pull on her bindings. "This is not my bedroom," she thought. "They've taken me someplace else." Slowly she marshaled the inner calmness. She grew aware of the smell of her own stale sweat with its chemical infusion of fear.
"Where's Paul?" she asked herself. "My son, what have they done to him?"
Calmness. She forced herself to it, using the ancient routines. But terror remained so near.
"Leto, where are you, Leto?"
She sensed a diminishing in the dark. It began with shadows. Dimensions separated became new thorns of awareness. White. A line under a door.
"I'm on the floor."
People walking. She sensed it through the floor. Jessica squeezed back the memory of terror.
"I must remain calm, alert, and prepared. I may get only one chance."
Again she forced the inner calmness. The ungainly thumping of her heartbeats evened, shaping out time. She counted back.
"I was unconscious about an hour."
She closed her eyes, focused her awareness onto the approaching footsteps.
"Four people."
She counted the differences in their steps.
"I must pretend I'm still unconscious."
She relaxed against the cold floor, testing her body's readiness, heard a door open, sensed increased light through her eyelids. Feet approached. Someone standing over her.
"You are awake," rumbled a basso voice. "Do not pretend."
She opened her eyes. The Baron Vladimir Harkonnen stood over her. Around them, she recognized the cellar room where Paul had slept, saw his cot at one side, empty. Suspensor lamps were brought in by guards, distributed near the open door. There was a glare of light in the hallway beyond that hurt her eyes. She looked up at the Baron. He wore a yellow cape that bulged over his portable suspensors. The fat cheeks were two cherubic mounds beneath spider-black eyes.
"The drug was timed," he rumbled. "We knew to the minute when you'd be coming out of it."
"How could that be?" she wondered.
"They'd have to know my exact weight, my metabolism, my..."
"Yui!"
"Such a pity you must remain gagged," the Baron said. "We could have such an interesting conversation."
"Yui's the only one it could be," she thought. "How?"
The Baron glanced behind him at the door.
"Come in, Peter."
She had never before seen the man who entered to stand beside the Baron, but the face was known, and the man, Peter de Vries, the Mentat assassin. She studied him, hawk features, blue-ink eyes that suggested he was a native of Arrakis, but subtleties of movement and stance told her he was not, and his flesh was too well firmed with water. He was tall, though slender, and something about him suggested effeminacy.
"Such a pity we cannot have our conversation, my dear Lady Jessica," the Baron said. "However, I'm aware of your abilities." He glanced at the Mentat. "Isn't that true, Biter?"
"As you say, Baron," the man said.
The voice was tenor. It touched her spine with a wash of coldness. She had never heard such a chill voice. To one with the Bene Gesserit training, the voice screamed, "Killer!"
"I have a surprise for Peter," the Baron said. "He thinks he has come here to collect his reward, you, Lady Jessica. But I wish to demonstrate a thing, that he does not really want you."
"You play with me, Baron?" Peter asked, and he smiled.
Seeing that smile, Jessica wondered that the Baron didn't leap to defend himself from this Peter. Then she corrected herself. The Baron couldn't read that smile. He didn't have the training.
"In many ways, Peter is quite naive," the Baron said. "He doesn't admit to himself what a deadly creature you are, Lady Jessica. I'd show him, but it'd be a foolish risk."
The Baron smiled at Peter, whose face had become a waiting mask.
"I know what Peter really wants. Peter wants power."
"You promised I could have her," Peter said.
The tenor voice had lost some of its cold reserve. Jessica heard the clue tones in the man's voice, allowed herself an inward shudder.
How could the Baron have made such an animal out of a Mentat?
"I give you a choice, Peter," the Baron said.
"What choice?"
The Baron snapped fat fingers.
This woman an exile from the Imperium? Or the Duchy of Atreides on Arrakis to rule as you see fit in my name?
Jessica watched the Baron's spider eyes study Piter.
You could be Duke here in all but name, the Baron said.
Is my Leto dead, then? Jessica asked herself. She felt a silent wail begin somewhere in her mind. The Baron kept his attention on the Mentat.
Understand yourself, Piter. You want her because she was a Duke's woman, a symbol of his power, beautiful, useful, exquisitely trained for her role. But an entire duchy, Piter, that's more than a symbol, that's the reality. With it you could have many women, and more.
You do not joke with Piter? The Baron turned with that dancing lightness the suspensers gave him.
Joke? I? Remember, I am giving up the boy. You heard what the traitor said about the lad's training. They are alike, this mother and son. Deadly.
The Baron smiled.
I must go now. I will send in the guard I've reserved for this moment. He's stone deaf. His orders will be to convey you on the first leg of your journey into exile. He will subdue this woman if he sees her gain control of you. He'll not permit you to untie her gag until you're off Arrakis. If you choose not to leave, he has other orders.
You don't have to leave, Piter said.
I've chosen.
Aha! The Baron chortled. Such quick decision can mean only one thing.
I will take the duchy, Piter said. And Jessica thought, doesn't Piter know the Baron's lying to him? But how could he know? He's a twisted mentat. The Baron glanced down at Jessica.
Is it not wonderful that I know Piter so well? I wagered with my master at arms that this would be Piter's choice. Ha! Well, I leave now. This is much better. Ah, much better. You understand, Lady Jessica, I had no rancor toward you. It's a necessity. Much better this way, yes. And I've not actually ordered you destroyed. When it's asked of me what happened to you, I can shrug it off in all truth.
You leave it to me, then? Piter asked.
The guard I send you will take your orders, the Baron said. Whatever is done, I leave to you.
He stared at Piter.
Yes. There will be no blood on my hands here. It's your decision. Yes. I know nothing of it. You will wait until I've gone before doing whatever you must do. Yes. Well, yes. Yes. Good.
He fears the questioning of a truth-sayer, Jessica thought. Who? Ah, the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen, of course. If he knows he must face her questions, then the Emperor is in on this for sure. Ah, my poor Leto. With one last glance at Jessica, the Baron turned, went out the door. She followed him with her eyes, thinking, it's as the Reverend Mother warned, too potent an adversary.
Two Harkonnen troopers entered. Another, his face a scarred mask, followed and stood in the doorway with drawn lace gun.
The deaf one, Jessica thought, studying the scarred face. The Baron knows I could use the voice on any other man. Scarface looked at Piter.
We've a boy in a litter outside. What are your orders?
Piter spoke to Jessica.
I thought of binding you by a threat held over your son, but I begin to see that would not have worked. I let emotion cloud reason. Bad policy for a mentat.
He looked at the first pair of troopers, turning so the deaf one could read his lips.
Take them into the desert, as the traitor suggested for the boy. His plan is a good one. The worms will destroy all evidence. Their bodies must never be found.
You don't wish to dispatch them yourself? Scarface asked.
He reads lips, Jessica thought.
I follow my Baron's example, Piter said. Take them where the traitor said.
Jessica heard the harsh mentat control in Piter's voice, thought, he too fears the truth-sayer.
Piter shrugged, turned, and went through the doorway. He hesitated there, and Jessica thought he might turn back for a last look at her, but he went out without turning.
"Me, I wouldn't like the thought of facing that truthsayer after this night's work," Scarface said.
"You ain't likely ever to run into that old witch," one of the other troopers said.
He went around to Jessica's head, bent over her.
"It ain't getting our work done standing around here chattering. Take her feet and—"
"Why don't we kill him here?" Scarface asked.
"Too messy,"
the first one said.
"Unless he wants to strangle him. Me, I likes a nice straightforward job. Drop him on a desert like that traitor said. Cut him once or twice. Leave the evidence for the worms. Nothing to clean up afterwards."
"Yeah, well, I guess you're right," Scarface said.
Jessica listened to them, watching, registering. But the gag blocked her voice, and there was the deaf one to consider. Scarface holstered his laser gun, took her feet. They lifted her like a sack of grain, maneuvered her through the door, and dumped her onto a suspensor buoyed litter with another bound figure. As they turned her, fitting her to the litter, she saw her companion's face. Paul. He was bound, but not gagged. His face was no more than 10 centimeters from hers, eyes closed, his breathing even.
"Is he drugged?" she wondered.
The troopers lifted the litter, and Paul's eyes opened the smallest fraction, dark slits staring at her.
"He mustn't try the voice," she prayed. "The deaf guard."
Paul's eyes closed. He had been practicing the awareness breathing, calming his mind, listening to their captors. The deaf one posed a problem, but Paul contained his despair. The mind-calming Bene Gesserit regimen his mother had taught him kept him poised, ready to expand any opportunity. Paul allowed himself another slit-eyed inspection of his mother's face. She appeared unharmed, gagged, though. He wondered who could have captured her. His own captivity was plain enough, to bed with a capsule prescribed by Yui, awakening to find himself bound to this litter. Perhaps a similar thing had befallen her. Logic said the traitor was Yui, but he held final decision in abeyance. There was no understanding it, a Sook doctor a traitor. The litter tipped slightly as the Harkonnen troopers maneuvered it through a doorway into starlit night. A suspensor buoy rasped against the doorway, then they were on sand, feet grating in it. A thopter wing loomed overhead, blotting the stars. The litter settled to the ground. Paul's eyes adjusted to the faint light. He recognized the deaf trooper as the man who opened the thopter door, peered inside at the green gloom illuminated by the instrument panel. "This the thopter we're supposed to use?" he asked, and turned to watch his companion's lips.
"Is the one the traitor said was fixed for desert work," the other said.
Scarface nodded.
"But it's one of them little liaison jobs. Ain't room in there for more'n them and two of us."
"Two's enough," said the litter-bearer, moving up close and presenting his lips for reading. "We can take care of it from here on, Kinnett."
"The Baron, he told me to make sure what happened to them two," Scarface said.
"What are you so worried about?" asked another trooper from behind the litter-bearer.
"She is a Bene Gesserit witch," the deaf one said. "They have powers."
"Ah," the litter-bearer made the sign of the fist at his ear. "One of them, eh? Know what you mean?"
The trooper behind him grunted.
"She'll be worm meat soon enough. Don't suppose even a Bene Gesserit witch has powers over one of them big worms, eh, Chigo?"
He nudged the litter-bearer.
"Yep," the litter-bearer said.
He returned to the litter, took Jessica's shoulders.
"Come on, Kinnett. You can go along if you want to make sure what happens."
"It is nice of you to invite me, Chigo," Scarface said.
Jessica felt herself lifted, the wing shadow spinning, stars. She was pushed into the rear of the thopter, her crimskull fiber bindings examined, and she was strapped down. Paul was jammed in beside her, strapped securely, and she noted his bonds were simple rope.
Scarface, the deaf one they called Kinnett, took his place in front.
The litter-bearer, the one they called Chigo, came around and took the other front seat. Kinnett closed his door, bent to the controls. The thopter took off in a wing-tucked surge, headed south over the shield wall. Chigo tapped his companion's shoulder, said,
"Why don't you turn around and keep an eye on them two?"
"Sure you know the way to go?"
Kinnett watched Chigo's lips.
"I listened to the traitor same as you."
Kinnett swiveled his seat. Jessica saw the glint of starlight on a laser gun in his hand.
The Thopter's light-walled interior seemed to collect illumination as her eyes adjusted, but the guard's scarred face remained dim. Jessica tested her seatbelt, found it loose. She felt roughness in the strap against her left arm, realized the strap had been almost severed, would snap at a sudden jerk. "Has someone been at this Thopter preparing it for us?" she wondered. "Who?" Slowly she twisted her bound feet clear of Paul's. "Sure do seem a shame to waste a good-looking woman like this," Scarface said. "You ever have any highborn types?" He turned to look at the pilot. "Bene Gesserit ain't all highborn," the pilot said. "But they all looks heighty." "He can see me plain enough," Jessica thought. She brought her bound legs up onto the seat, curled into a sinuous ball, staring at Scarface. "Real pretty she is," Kinnett said. He wet his lips with his tongue. "Sure do seem a shame." He looked at Chigo. "You thinking what I think you're thinking?" the pilot asked. "Who'd be to know?" the guard asked. "Afterwards." He shrugged. "I just never had me no highborns. Might never get a chance like this one again." "You lay a hand on my mother," Paul grated. He glared at Scarface. "Hey," the pilot laughed. "Cub's got a bark. Ain't got no bite, though." And Jessica thought, Paul's pitching his voice too high. It may work, though. They flew on in silence. These poor fools, Jessica thought, studying her guards and reviewing the Baron's words. They'll be killed as soon as they report success on their mission. The Baron wants no witnesses. The Thopter banked over the southern rim of the shield wall, and Jessica saw a moon-shadowed expanse of sand beneath them. "This ought to be far enough," the pilot said. "The traitor said to put him on the sand anywhere near the shield wall." He dipped the craft toward the dunes in a long falling stoop, brought it up stiffly over the desert surface. Jessica saw Paul begin taking the rhythmic breaths of the calming exercise. He closed his eyes, opened them. Jessica stared, helpless to aid him. "He hasn't mastered the voice yet," she thought. "If he fails..." The Thopter touched sand with a soft lurch, and Jessica, looking north back across the shield wall, saw a shadow of wings settle out of sight up there. "Someone's following us," she thought. "Who?" Then, "The ones the Baron set to watch this pair, and there'll be watchers for the watchers, too." Chigo shut off his wing rotors. Silence flooded in upon them. Jessica turned her head. She could see out the window beyond Scarface a dim glow of light from a rising moon. A frosted rim of rock rising from the desert, sandblast ridges streaked its sides. Paul cleared his throat. The pilot said, "Now, Kinnett?" "I don't know, Chigo." Chigo turned, said, "Ah, look." He reached out for Jessica's skirt. "Remove her gag," Paul commanded. Jessica felt the words rolling in the air. The tone, the timbre, excellent, imperative, very sharp. A slightly lower pitch would have been better, but it could still fall within this man's spectrum. Chigo shifted his hand up to the band around Jessica's mouth, slipped the knot on the gag. "Stop that," Kinnett ordered. "Ah, shut your trap," Chigo said. "Her hands are tied." He freed the knot and the binding dropped. His eyes glittered as he studied Jessica. Kinnett put a hand on the pilot's arm. "Look, Chigo, no need to..." Jessica twisted her neck, spat out the gag. She pitched her voice in low, intimate tones. "Gentlemen, no need to fight over me." At the same time, she writhed sinuously for Kinnett's benefit. She saw them grow tense, knowing that in this instant they were convinced of the need to fight over her. Their disagreement required no other reason. In their minds, they were fighting over her. She held her face high in the instrument glow to be sure Kinnett would read her lips, said, "You mustn't disagree." They drew farther apart, glanced warily at each other. "Is any woman worth fighting over?" she asked. By uttering the words, by being there, she made herself infinitely worth their fighting. Paul clamped his lips tightly closed, forced himself to be silent. There had been the one chance for him to succeed with the voice. Now everything depended on his mother, whose experience went so far beyond his own. "Yeah," Scarface said. "No need to fight over." His hand flashed toward the pilot's neck. The blow was met by a splash of metal that caught the arm and in the same motion slammed into Kinnett's chest.
Scarface groaned, sagged backward against his door.
"Thought I was some dummy, didn't know that trick," Chico said.
He brought back his hand, revealing the knife. It glittered in reflected moonlight.
"Now for the cub," he said, and leaned toward Paul.
"No need for that," Jessica murmured. Chico hesitated. "Wouldn't you rather have me cooperative?" Jessica asked. "Give the boy a chance." Her lip curled in a sneer. "Little enough chance he'd have out there in that sand. Give him that and," she smiled, "you could find yourself well rewarded."
Chico glanced left, right, returned his attention to Jessica.
"I've heard me what can happen to a man in this desert," he said. "Boy might find the knife a kindness."
"Is it so much I ask?" Jessica pleaded.
"You're trying to trick me," Chico muttered.
"I don't want to see my son die," Jessica said. "Is that a trick?"
Chico moved back, elbowed the door latch. He grabbed Paul, dragged him across the seat, pushed him half out the door, and held the knife poised.
"What'll you do, cub, if I cut your bonds?"
"He'll leave here immediately and head for those rocks," Jessica said.
"Is that what you'll do, cub?"
Chico asked. Paul's voice was properly surly.
"Yes."
The knife moved down, slashed the bindings of his legs. Paul felt the hand on his back to hurl him down onto the sand, feigned a lurch against the doorframe for purchase, turned as though to catch himself, lashed out with his right foot. The toe was aimed with a precision that did credit to his long years of training, as though all of that training focused on this instant. Almost every muscle of his body cooperated in the placement of it. The tip struck the soft part of Chigo's abdomen just below the sternum, slammed upward with terrible force over the liver and through the diaphragm to crush the right ventricle of the man's heart. With one gurgling scream, the guard jerked backward across the seats. Paul, unable to use his hands, continued his tumble onto the sand, landing with a roll that took up the force and brought him back to his feet in one motion. He dove back into the cabin, found the knife, and held it in his teeth while his mother sawed her bonds. She took the blade and freed his hands.
"I could have handled him," she said. "He'd have had to cut my bindings. That was a foolish risk."
"I saw the opening and used it," he said. She heard the harsh control in his voice, said, "Yui's house sign is scrawled on the ceiling of this cabin." He looked up, saw the curling symbol.
"Get out and let us study this craft," she said. "There's a bundle under the pilot's seat. I felt it when we got in."
"Bomb?"
"Doubt it. There's something peculiar here."
Paul leaped out to the sand, and Jessica followed. She turned, reached under the seat for the strange bundle, seeing Chigo's feet close to her face, feeling dampness on the bundle as she removed it, realizing the dampness was the pilot's blood. Waste of moisture, she thought, knowing that this was Arakeen thinking. Paul stared around them, saw the rock scarp lifting out of the desert like a beach rising from the sea, wind-carved palisades beyond. He turned back as his mother lifted the bundle from the thopter, saw her stare across the dunes toward the shield wall. He looked to see what drew her attention, saw another thopter swooping toward them, realized they'd not have time to clear the bodies out of this thopter and escape.
"Run, Paul!" Jessica shouted. "It's Harkonnen's!"
Arrakis teaches the attitude of the knife, chopping off what's incomplete and saying, "Now it's complete, because it's ended here." From Collected Sayings of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
A man in Harkonnen uniform skidded to a stop at the end of the hall, stared in at Yui, taking in at a single glance Mape's body, the sprawled form of the Duke, Yui standing there. The man held a lace gun in his right hand. There was a casual air of brutality about him, a sense of toughness and poise that sent a shiver through Yui.
"Sardaukar," Yui thought. "A bashar by the look of him. Probably one of the Emperor's own, sent here to keep an eye on things. No matter what the uniform, there's no disguising them."
"You're Yui," the man said.
He looked speculatively at the Sook school ring on the doctor's hair, stared once at the diamond tattoo, and then met Yui's eyes.
"I am Yui," the doctor said.
"You can relax, Yui," the man said. "When you dropped the house shields, we came right in. Everything's under control here. Is this the Duke?"
"This is the Duke."
"Dead?"
"Merely unconscious. I suggest you tie him."
"Did you do for these others?"
He glanced back down the hall where Mape's body lay.
"More's the pity,"
Yui muttered.
"Pity,"
the Sardaukar sneered. He advanced, looked down at Leto. "So that's the Great Red Duke."
"If I had doubts about what this man is, that would end them," Yui thought. "Only the Emperor calls the Atreides the Red Dukes."
The Sardaukar reached down, cut the Red Hawk insignia from Leto's uniform. "Little souvenir," he said. "Where's the ducal signet ring?"
"He doesn't have it on him," Yui said.
"I can see that," the Sardaukar snapped.
Yui stiffened, swallowed. "If they press me, bring in a truth-sayer. They'll find out about the ring, about the thopter I prepared. All will fail." "Sometimes the Duke sent the ring with a messenger as surety that an order came directly from him," Yui said.
"Must be damned trusted messengers," the Sardaukar muttered.
"Aren't you going to tie him?" Yui ventured.
"How long will he be unconscious?"
2 hours or so. I wasn't as precise with his dosage as I was for the woman and boy."
The Sardaukar spurned the Duke with his toe. "This was nothing to fear even when awake. When will the woman and boy awaken?"
"About 10 minutes."
"So soon?"
"I was told the Baron would arrive immediately behind his men."
"So he will. You'll wait outside, Yui."
He shot a hard glance at Yui.
"Now!"
Yui glanced at Leto. "What about—"
"He'll be delivered to the Baron all properly trussed like a roast for the oven."
Again the Sardaukar looked at the diamond tattoo on Yui's forehead.
"You're known. You'll be safe enough in the halls. We've no more time for chit-chat, traitor. I hear the others coming."
"Traitor," Yui thought.
He lowered his gaze, pressed past the Sardaukar, knowing this as a foretaste of how history would remember him. Yui the traitor. He passed more bodies on his way to the front entrance and glanced at them, fearful that one might be Paul or Jessica. All were house troopers or wore Harkonnen uniform. Harkonnen guards came alert, staring at him as he emerged from the front entrance into flame-lighted night. The palms along the road had been fired to illuminate the house. Black smoke from the flammables used to ignite the trees poured upward through orange flames.
"It's the traitor," someone said.
"The Baron will want to see you soon," another said.
"I must get to the thopter," Yui thought. "I must put the ducal signet where Paul will find it," and fear struck him. "If Idaho suspects me or grows impatient, if he doesn't wait and go exactly where I told him, Jessica and Paul will not be saved from the carnage. I'll be denied even the smallest relief from my act."
The Harkonnen guard released his arm, said, "Wait over there, out of the way." Abruptly, Yui saw himself as cast away in this place of destruction, spared nothing, given not the smallest pity.
"Idaho must not fail."
Another guard bumped into him, barked, "Stay out of the way, you!"
"Even when they've profited by me, they despise me," Yui thought. He straightened himself as he was pushed aside, regained some of his dignity.
"Wait for the Baron," a guard officer snarled. Yui nodded, walked with controlled casualness along the front of the house, turned the corner into shadows out of sight of the burning palms. Quickly, every step betraying his anxiety, Yui made for the rear yard beneath the conservatory where the thopter waited, the craft they had placed there to carry away Paul and his mother. A guard stood at the open rear door of the house, his attention focused on the lighted hall and men banging through there, searching from room to room. How confident they were! Yui hugged the shadows, worked his way around the thopter, eased open the door on the side away from the guard. He felt under the front seats for the Fremkit he had hidden there, lifted a flap and slipped in the ducal signet. He felt the crinkling of the spice paper there, the note he had written, pressed the ring into the paper. He removed his hand, resealed the pack. Softly, Yui closed the thopter door, worked his way back to the corner of the house and around toward the flaming trees.
"Now it is done," he thought.
Once more he emerged into the light of the blazing palms. He pulled his cloak around him, stared at the flames.
"Soon I will know. Soon I will see the Baron and I will know. And the Baron, he will encounter a small tooth."
This ends Disc 7. Dune, Disc 8.
There is a legend that the instant the Duke Leto Atreides died, a meteor streaked across the skies above his ancestral palace on Caladan. The Princess Irulan. Introduction to a Child's History of Muad'Dib.
The Baron Vladimir Harkonnen stood at a viewport of the grounded lighter he was using as a command post. Out the port he saw a flame-lighted knight of Arakeen.
his attention focused on the distant shield wall where his secret weapon was doing its work. Explosive artillery. The guns nibbled at the caves where the Duke's fighting men had retreated for a last-ditch stand. Slowly measured bites of orange glare, showers of rock and dust in the brief illumination, and the Duke's men were being sealed off to die by starvation, caught like animals in their burrows. The Baron could feel the distant chomping, a drumbeat carried to him through the ship's metal. Brump, brump, then brump, brump.
Who would think of reviving artillery in this day of shields?
The thought was a chuckle in his mind.
But it was predictable the Duke's men would run for those caves. And the Emperor will appreciate my cleverness in preserving the lives of our mutual force.
He adjusted one of the little suspensors that guarded his fat body against the pull of gravity. A smile creased his mouth, pulled at the lines of his jowls.
A pity to waste such fighting men as the Duke's, he thought.
He smiled more broadly, laughing at himself.
Pity should be cruel.
He nodded. Failure was, by definition, expendable. The whole universe sat there, open to the man who could make the right decisions. The uncertain rabbits had to be exposed, made to run for their burrows. Else how could you control them and breed them? He pictured his fighting men as bees, routing the rabbits. And he thought,
the day hums sweetly when you have enough bees working for you.
A door opened behind him. The Baron studied the reflection in the night-blackened viewport before turning. Peiter de Vries advanced into the chamber, followed by Uman Kudu, the captain of the Baron's personal guard. There was a motion of men just outside the door, the mutton faces of his guard, their expressions carefully sheep-like in his presence. The Baron turned. Peiter touched finger to forelock in his mocking salute.
"Good news, my lord. The Sardaukar have brought in the Duke."
"Of course they have,"
the Baron rumbled. He studied the somber mask of villainy on Peiter's effeminate face, and the eyes, those shaded slits of bluest blue in blue.
"Soon I must remove him,"
the Baron thought.
"He has almost outlasted his usefulness, almost reached the point of positive danger to my person. First, though, he must make the people of Arrakis hate him. Then they will welcome my darling, Fade Rautha, as a savior."
The Baron shifted his attention to the guard captain, Uman Kudu. Scissors line of jaw muscles, chin like a boot toe, a man to be trusted because the captain's vices were known.
"First, where is the traitor who gave me the Duke?"
the Baron asked.
"I must give the traitor his reward."
Peiter turned on one toe, motioned to the guard outside. A bit of black movement there, and Yue walked through. His motions were stiff and stringy. The mustache drooped beside his purple lips. Only the old eyes seemed alive. Yue came to a stop 3 paces into the room, obeying a motion from Peiter, and stood there staring across the open space at the Baron.
"Ah, Dr. Yue."
"Milord Harkonnen."
"You've given us the Duke, I hear."
"My half of the bargain, my lord."
The Baron looked at Peiter. Peiter nodded. The Baron looked back at Yue.
"The letter of the bargain, eh? And I..."
He spat the words out.
"What was I to do in return?"
"You remember quite well, my lord Harkonnen."
And Yue allowed himself to think now, hearing the loud silence of clocks in his mind. He had seen the subtle betrayals in the Baron's manner. One was indeed dead, gone far beyond their reach. Otherwise there'd still be a hold on the weak doctor. The Baron's manner showed there was no hold. It was ended.
"Do I?"
the Baron asked.
"You promised to deliver my Wanna from her agony."
The Baron nodded.
"Oh, yes. Now I remember. So I did. That was my promise. That was how we bent the Imperial conditioning. You couldn't endure seeing your Bene Gesserit witch grovel in Peiter's pain amplifiers. Well, the Baron Vladimir Hakonin always keeps his promises. I told you I'd free her from the agony and permit you to join her. So be it.
He waved a hand at Piter. Piter's blue eyes took a glazed look. His movement was cat-like in its sudden fluidity. The knife in his hand glistened like a claw as it flashed into Yui's back. The old man stiffened, never taking his attention from the Baron.
So join her,
the Baron spat. Yui stood, swaying. His lips moved with careful precision, and his voice came in oddly measured cadence.
You think you defeated me? You think I did not know what I bought for my Wala?
He toppled. No bending or softening. It was like a tree falling.
So join her,
the Baron repeated. But his words were like a weak echo. Yui had filled him with a sense of foreboding. He whipped his attention to Piter, watched the man wipe the blade on a scrap of cloth, watched the creamy look of satisfaction in the blue eyes.
So that's how he kills by his own hand, the Baron thought. It's well to know. He did give us the duke, the Baron asked.
Of a certainty, my lord, Piter said.
Then get him in here.
Piter glanced at the guard captain, who whirled to obey. The Baron looked down at Yui. From the way the man had fallen, you could suspect oak in him instead of bones.
I never could bring myself to trust a traitor, the Baron said. Not even a traitor I created.
He glanced at the night-shrouded viewport. That black bag of stillness out there was his, the Baron knew. There was no more crump of artillery against the shield wall caves. The burrow traps were sealed off. Quite suddenly, the Baron's mind could conceive of nothing more beautiful than that utter emptiness of black. Unless it were white on the black. Plated white on the black. Porcelain white. But there was still the feeling of doubt. What had the old fool of a doctor meant? Of course he'd probably known what would happen to him in the end, but that bit about thinking he'd been defeated, you think you defeated me? What had he meant? The Duke Leto Atreides came through the door. His arms were bound in chains, the eagle face streaked with dirt. His uniform was torn where someone had ripped off his insignia. There were tatters at his waist where the shield belt had been removed without first freeing the uniform ties. The Duke's eyes held a glazed, insane look.
Well,
the Baron said. He hesitated, drawing in a deep breath. He knew he had spoken too loudly. This moment, long envisioned, had lost some of its savor.
Damn that cursed doctor through all eternity.
I believe the good Duke is drugged, Piter said. That's how Yui caught him for us.
Piter turned to the Duke.
Aren't you drugged, my dear Duke?
The voice was far away. Leto could feel the chains, the ache of muscles, his cracked lips, his burning cheeks, the dry taste of thirst whispering its grit in his mouth. But sounds were dull, hidden by a cottony blanket, and he saw only dim shapes through the blanket.
What of the woman and the boy, Piter? The Baron asked. Any word yet?
Piter's tongue darted over his lips.
You've heard something, the Baron snapped. What?
Piter glanced at the guard captain, back to the Baron.
The men who were sent to do the job, my lord, they've been found.
Well, they report everything satisfactory.
They're dead, my lord.
Of course they are. What I want to know is...
They were dead when found, my lord.
The Baron's face went livid.
And the woman and boy?
No sign, my lord, but there was a worm. It came while the scene was being investigated. Perhaps it's as we wished, an accident. Possibly...
We do not deal in possibilities, Piter. What of the missing Thopter? Does that suggest anything to my mentat?
One of the Duke's men obviously escaped in it, my lord. Killed our pilot and escaped.
Which of the Duke's men?
It was a clean, silent killing, my lord. Howard, perhaps? Or that Halleck one? Possibly Idaho? Or any top lieutenant?
Possibilities,
the Baron muttered.